Welcome to the Back Porch Education Podcast. Today on the show, Steve and I delve into the question of estimation when it comes to our students.
Jason, I'm going to guess and say that you once again brought a poem. I'm even going to guess that it's by Robert Frost.
You're right on both counts, yeah. Steve. This is it.
Someday I'll be a prophet.
But you might have to lose your sight first, like Tiresias.
Yes, that's right.
Well, or Milton.
That's right.
But I don't know, man. I don't know that it's worth it. Although I've known some people without sight who were wise indeed, but that's a story for another time. Robert Frost brought us this wonderful poem, and it is entitled Leaves Compared with Flowers. And I especially like it because it fits our discussion today, the one we want to have about rightly esteeming or rightly valuing our students, their work, their efforts, their abilities, etc. So, without further ado, Robert Frost once again, and the poem is entitled Leaves Compared with Flowers. A tree's leaves may be ever so good, so may its bark, so may its wood. But unless you put the right thing to its root, it will never show much flower or fruit. But I may be one who does not care ever to have tree bloom or bear. Leaves for smooth and bark for rough. Leaves and bark may be tree enough. Some giant trees have bloomed so small they might as well have none at all. Late in life, I have come on fern. Now lichens are due to have their turn. I bade men tell me which, in brief, which is fairer, flower or leaf. They did not have the wit to say, leaves by night and flower by day. leaves and bark, to lean against and hear in the dark. Petals I may have once pursued, leaves are all my darker mood.
All right, well, a lot to be thought about there.
Yeah, I don't want the mood to turn too dark.
But,
however, I've been meaning to tell you, this is an intervention.
Leave me alone.
Nice. No, I don't know. Why do I like this poem? For estimation. Because no one had the wit to say leaves by dark and flower by day. Frost, very tongue-in-cheek, as is his custom, reveals a bit of wisdom and pokes fun at everyone else at the same time, right? He kind of rolls it up into a ball and says, This is the answer that you should have got. And without putting too fine a point on it, he rightly esteems the flower and the leaf in that moment.
Right. Yeah, each has their place and each are their thing. And it's the human nature to say one is a superior to the other when they're indispensable to each other, mm-hmm. right? And great for different reasons.
Right.
So it's all about the criteria at that point, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So with our topic today, it's yet another instance where a listener has offered us up a question that caught our attention.
Whoa, listener and also former guest.
Well, that's right. Some may have heard the interview conducted with Josie Parker about her experiences at Cambridge University, where mm-hmm. she is still pursuing now her master's degree. But she sent us this graciously through Facebook, And we encourage those of you listening to us to do the same. Her question had to do with how does a teacher not either over or underestimate their students? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot in that, right? There's a whole buffet of possibilities.
Right.
So I want to try as much as we can to stay focused on this particular aspect of, I have a student, how do I distinguish what their best place is?
Mm-hmm.
Are they leaf or flower?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Who are they?
Right.
Because I don't teach to turn everyone into myself. That would be awful.
Sure, sure.
I don't even teach to turn everyone into the same type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is not we sometimes talk about an ideal student, but no real student is ever going to rise to that ideal.
Right.
And each is going to rise in different ways.
True.
Towards different parts of that ideal.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked even before we hit the record button that assessment's going to have to come up, and I think that's a lot of the answer from my perspective, is that to know a student and where they should be, what their place is in my classroom, in my estimation,
mm-hmm.
is constant interaction, constant assessment,
right.
Constant relationship that allow, and of course there's a lot that works against that. If I have too many students, then the school has placed me in a position of not being able to properly estimate my students.
Right.
If the student is reticent to really show me what they got, then
mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a false estimate
mm-hmm.
there. If I'm just not very good at estimation,
yeah,
which is an art, right?
It comes, absolutely.
Some people never develop it, and they probably shouldn't be in teaching. But even those who have developed it, it's taken time, and it's taken trial and error, and it's unfortunately at times taken some tears
mm-hmm.
as well as some joyous moments to figure out and to continue to figure. I don't know that any of us have ever arrived at I now know how to evaluate my students.
Right.
And I am regularly surprised. I don't know how many times I've picked up a paper expecting A
yeah.
and gotten something much closer to Z
yeah.
because the student has made a turn, or we found something that really ignited their writing abilities.
Right.
Or mom and dad are dishing out some money for tutorials
right.
or something.
Sure, whatever the cause may be. But yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it, right? I think that's part of what makes teaching so enjoyable is the willingness or the constant possibility that your estimations may be upset.
Yes.
Right. Just when you think, yeah, I've pretty well got this batch, this group figured out. Somebody comes along or a particular student interacts with a particular assignment and you go, wow.
Yep.
You know, that was special. That was something other than what I was expecting. I don't know. I think actually of one of the books that you recommended I read one time, Gilbert Hyatt's Art of Teaching,
yep.
which we've talked about on here, you know, where Hyatt gets to a point in the book where he says, you know, for the new teacher, everything is so new and exciting and wow, and every kid is just like this most unique and individual child, and everything is different. But that at a certain point, once you've been through the cycle a good many times, you realize that there are, I forget exactly how he says it, but essentially that there are certain kinds of students.
Yep.
And they kind of fall into different groups, and then it's only rarely that you will get a student. The number 5 and 6 comes up, but I can't remember what it is. But basically that, I guess what he's saying is that there are five or six kinds of students.
Yep.
And that every once in a while you get someone who really is...
sort of an outlier.
Yeah, breaking the mold in some way. But most of the time, no.
Well, there's an author that fascinates me at times because he looks at things from such a different perspective, Malcolm Gladwell. And Gladwell has a book called Outliers. Mm-hmm. That his thesis is that it's the people that don't fit the normal estimations that make most of the revolutions in our world. That if you're a normal person or if you fit neatly into a box, mm-hmm. you're probably not going to ever get anybody else out of that. And I value Hyatt, and in fact see it myself, having taught for a number of years now. I'll see in one student something I've seen in another student, mm-hmm. and that if it helps me understand them, I think it's valuable. If it starts to pigeonhole that student,
right?
If I'm too quick to judgment, I guess that's one of the terms I thought of when we were considering this question was prejudice.
Okay.
Prejudgment.
Right.
Quick judgment.
Right.
I've certainly been guilty from time to time of thinking to myself, oh, that's what that student's like.
I've seen this before.
Yes. And then you kind of stumble because something at some point hopefully reveals to you you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And Josie's brought out the question of over or underestimation. It's such a fine line that it's. I would say over and underestimation is a very typical experience. It's how far you either over or underestimate. Hitting it right on the nail is often a difficult thing, especially in our fragmented world. I think of my father who went to a one-room schoolhouse for I think 6 or 8 years. Now they had several teachers during that time because they didn't pay very much back in the 30s, and they had people run through there rather quickly.
Sure.
But when they did have one for a couple of years, teaching everything to everyone in that room, the dozen or two kids that were in that room at various grade levels, the amount of knowledge and understanding about those kids, because they're teaching all the subjects.
Right.
I'm kind of cursed with only seeing one facet my student. And then I send him off the next hour where he might shine or suddenly disappear because it's math class or it's, you know,
PE. But you lose that information.
Right. I don't have
You're
any
not
clue.
Privy to it.
All I see is what I'm given for that brief period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I have people tell me all the time that I have this unfair advantage because I get to I estimate in part my students through their writing. Mm-hmm. I'm able to see into a part of them that many teachers feel isn't available to them, and I smile my kind smile and say, "But there isn't a subject on the face of the earth that you can't have them writing."
Right? Yeah, exactly. You could assign writing.
This is available to you with all of its pleasures, including grading all these essays.
Be my guest.
And again, you know, I have to work hard. Part of me knowing my students well is not putting myself in a position to where I'm too busy to know who they are.
Good point.
Having all of my students turn an essay in on the same day is a recipe for me to not give as much attention to each essay.
By necessity.
Right. So, like this year I have three.
Ooh, dude. Sorry to cut you off, but I'm living this right now, so that's why I'm thinking it is one of the key components of rightly estimating your students is to first not over or underestimate yourself.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
It really is.
It is.
I stumbled. That's a free one, guys. That word
no.
Yeah.
Is huge for a teacher because we have a tendency to be eager to learn ourselves.
Right.
I know many teachers who are working on advanced degrees even as they teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I know. It's true. Well,
with the online world, doing side gigs. I mean, that's sometimes the necessity of teaching is, you know, as they might say, a little tent making along the side, because you are on the low end of the earning power. But you're right that if I'm going to know my students correctly, I have to put myself in a position to be attentive to them.
Right. And your let me just tell you from experience, I'm experiencing it this semester, just your willpower or your desire, that's not enough. Right. So you say, okay, I'm going to have everybody turn in a paper the same day, right, towards the end of the quarter. And yeah, it's going to be a lot of reading for me. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of feedback. But I just love the students so much, I'll power through it.
Yeah.
If you've only overestimated yourself a little bit, then that might work. But if you've really and truly bitten off more than you can chew, you're not going to get there, right? Like, you are going to make sacrifices by necessity. Like, you got to sleep, right? You have to rest. You have to sleep.
And often what happens there that I don't think most teachers think through is, let's say that you do that, and then the feedback that you're limited to such a narrow and quick amount of feedback, that the student's response to that is, oh, he doesn't really care.
Right.
He barely reads these things.
Right.
He gave me like three sentences.
Yeah.
So next time,
negative feedback loop.
I'm not going to be given a clear estimate of my student, because the next piece of work I get from them is going to reflect what I ask of them in my first assessment. So yeah, I've taken to, if I have a lot of writing, I make sure, like I was going to give the example of my three sophomore classes. A paper is usually a 3-week process, and so I make sure that each of those three classes are in a different week. I'll start one week and start the second one the second week, and the third one the third week. It means that I almost always have papers to grade, but I only have a class of 12 or 18 papers.
Right.
As opposed to, you know,
12 or 50. 18 times 3.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That's a good point.
And so I would much rather drink from a fountain that's at that level than the fire hose.
Absolutely.
That's all in at once. And and like you said, and the other thing that many teachers do is don't think through the deadlines that are on them. If it's all coming in a couple of days before grades are due for a grading period, you've just determined that I'm not going to sleep.
Yep.
And I'm so much, we talked about this recently, so much of typical schooling is scheduling and looking at the clock and dealing with the fact that I have to pass these kids off every 45 minutes to somebody else, and we're all in agreement here about a schedule. Homeschool doesn't have that. But even there, again, as we know that our listeners are in traditional schooling as well as in home education, that can quickly become a deal between a parent teaching their child, right? Especially the overestimation. I mean, sometimes underestimation, I'll see that. Well,
sure. You know,
they only need to do 30 minutes of work a day or something.
Right.
Oops.
Right.
But yeah, I do see a lot of homeschool parents. I don't know if it's ego or if it's just closeness, but they think their kid can pull off more than they really can.
Right.
And they don't have a clear picture of who their students are.
Right.
Because they're their children.
Yeah.
And
So I don't think that is bad as long as you learn from that, right? Because I think that one way to make sure, let's see, how can I say this? One way to make sure that you don't overestimate your child or your student is to just go ahead and overestimate them and watch them fail, and then you go, okay, that's too much.
Right.
Like so you just, you learn, you make the mistake, you go ahead, and which that's maybe kind of a cop-out answer, but
it's a good,
I think it's iterative.
So which would be worse? to over or underestimate?
I think to underestimate is worse.
I agree. Okay. Because then you're setting a bar so low that if you try and raise it, you suddenly seem like you're
right.
way overestimating me.
Right.
Well, no.
What's the big idea?
There's sort of a norm here, and I shot so low.
Right.
I'm just trying to get you up to kind of the norm now. Whereas if you do overestimate.
Yeah.
And especially in the homeschool setting, I think it's easy to do. But even in a traditional school, again, if familiarity with the students,
mm-hmm.
new students, you might be thinking, well, you ought to know, and then you find out they don't, right?
Mm.
The key here, as you were saying, is listening,
yeah.
is being attentive.
Right.
If you're just convinced they ought to be up here.
Right.
And they're not. They're all a bunch of idiots.
Right.
But I'm not moving.
Mm-hmm.
You're now killing the kids.
Right.
If you shoot for the stars.
Sure.
And they don't make it, you now at least know what they're capable of.
That's right.
And you can come back down maybe just above their heads still and call them to a reasonable level of excellence.
Right.
As opposed to, that guy's ridiculous. I'm dropping his class.
Right. Exactly.
I'm going to be sick every day.
Hey, take his class. We never do anything.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
One of the most heartrending stories I've ever heard is from a former student who was at my school for a while and then went across town to another school. And I saw him one day and I'm asking him how things are going. He left our school over sports.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I got... You know, our little school didn't have sports, and he wanted to play baseball, and he'd been, and that's that big school had it was a private school still, but he told me this story about Bible class,
okay,
where they all the coaches did the Bible classes,
okay,
and Bible class was awesome because we don't do anything except that one time the principal came in to observe, and suddenly we have like all these worksheets and stuff going on. And then when he left, the guy's like, okay, guys, let's go back to normal. And he said, we just sit around and chew the fat. You know, we just talk. And it's such an awesome Bible class. Our Bible classes at this school, he's referring to the school I was at, you know, we actually had to learn things and there were grades and stuff.
Mm.
So from his perspective.
Yeah, sure.
It was... Unfortunately, what the student was gathering from that is Bible's not a serious subject.
Yeah.
It should just be chewing the fat.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I think, not to turn this whole thing into an over or underestimation of the church, but things like, you know, Sunday school should be, they underestimate their students.
Right. Right.
I think it's quite common in education to underestimate. I think it's quite common among adults to underestimate kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that your suggestion that you shoot over their heads and then come back down to what's realistic,
right,
is going to preserve the dignity of the study.
Yep.
Without
and the student
on, and the student, right?
Right, that they sort of have some purchase in it and
are often more capable,
right,
than
right, and feel good about well, I mean, nobody likes failing at something, and right. So when you go, ah, man, almost. Well, let me try one more time.
Yep.
Right.
Well, and a lot of school, I don't know if we think about this enough. I think we do like something like graduation or last day of school or whatnot. But a lot of school is the accomplishment of things. So if there's nothing expected of you
mm-hmm.
and you know you're really not accomplishing anything, that one of the most significant feelings of academics is the completion of a significant paper,
right,
or the completion of a book. I recently was struck by the fact that most of my students read electronically now, and so they don't have that sense of working their way through a physical book.
That is weird, but that seems important.
So we were just finishing up Dante's Comedy, and I brought in my copy of the comedy and thunked it on the desk, and
they're
like, "What's that?" I said, that's what you're completing.
Right.
No way. They don't have that sense. It's a flat screen they're just whisking across. They don't have a visual encounter.
Right. Right.
They underestimate their own accomplishment.
Sure.
And I was like, you need to realize you just read a seriously large work.
Yep.
And you enjoyed it.
Yep.
What's that about? Because some of you have told me you've never read a book over 100 pages before.
Wow.
There we go.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
No, and that's not a, that's no easy read either.
No.
Well, yeah. Okay. So good. So what have we got so far? When it comes to not under or overestimating your students, we've got don't under or overestimate yourself.
Right.
Have your students write.
Yep.
Because evaluating their writing is key.
Shoot high.
Yeah.
And then come down.
Go ahead and overestimate. Right. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And then work it down through the iterative listening process, right? Getting feedback from them as you're giving feedback. I would say right in line with that, and also kind of with writing, is revising. As much as I learn from my students handing me a copy of some paper that they've written, I learn more about them when I see what their revisions are.
Yep.
So when they send me something and I go, yay, boo, like this, what about this? What'd you say here? What, you know, and I go through the whole thing and mark it up and hand it back. What they come back to me with, that gives me a lot of good information to esteem them properly, I think.
Yep.
Or accurately.
Yeah, well, and perhaps another low-hanging obvious fruit is that estimation is necessary to teaching, but it ought to be overt.
Mm.
A student shouldn't be mystified as to what your estimation of them is.
Right.
It bothers me when I see someone come through our high school who has significant athletic ability and has never been honestly assessed by his previous teachers.
Right.
It's always been, well, you're important to us for the basketball team, or you're a grade A recruit for baseball, so I'm just going to... I'm not getting into the political. Yeah.
Right.
And to have a student come in and for the first time understand, here's where I am, here's where I could be.
Hmm.
I wanna be a good thinker. I wanna write better.
Right.
I wanna read this book.
Uh-huh.
And no, I'm not happy that somebody will let me get away not reading it.
Right.
I'm annoyed that I actually have to put the work in.
Sure.
But I recognize that it's a good thing.
Right.
And if you keep that, if
well, those students have already displayed a certain amount of drive in one area of their lives.
Yeah.
Why would you do them the great disservice of so baldly and roundly underestimating them in another?
Yep.
Because God never gives out more than one talent at a time.
That's right. That's
like,
right.
Well, like, I mean, what are you doing?
All athletes are idiots.
Yeah. That,
I mean,
like,
you
could
got
it
that
be?
Memo. Sure.
Right. Yeah. That it says on the personnel manual.
Yeah.
I don't know.
An inordinate number of linemen in the NFL are from Harvard and Yale, if you've noticed.
Right.
It's not, it's unhuman at times. I think that the estimation, it should be individual as well. I've fallen in the... Well, I'll tell a story on my wife. My wife's from a large family,
right.
And her next oldest sibling is her brother,
okay.
Chuck, who is a doctor, medical doctor.
Nice.
And she followed him through all of school.
Right.
She was a grade or two, I think two grades below him.
Mm-hmm.
And so... He was quite smart. Not that my wife isn't smart. Let's be careful with how we tell
right,
the story.
Right, sure, right.
But she wasn't the 100% A+. I'm headed to medical school. My GPA is going to be, you know, an 8 on a 4.0 scale.
Right.
And this, she happened to go to the same college that he went to.
Mm.
And walked into a science class by a taught by someone who knew her older brother.
The expectations are already set.
Oh, you're Charles's sister. He's one of my finest. And she just said, I wanted to tell him right then and there, I'm not going to be. I'm going to see my way through this class and be thrilled with it.
Right.
I'm not Chuck, right? And so, and I've had that experience on more than one occasion of teaching siblings or teaching the child of someone that I know as an adult. I knew the parent. And estimating them not on the basis of that student, but on the basis of periphery.
Right.
Oh, you're so-and-so's kid. You've got to be smart. Or what happened to my wife, you know, I taught your older brother and he's a really good writer. I'm expecting big things.
Right.
As soon as you say that, you've put something on this kid that I don't think's legit.
Yep.
So, I see the scripture that comes to mind is 2 Corinthians 10, where Paul ridicules his opponents for comparing themselves with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby being fools.
Right.
I won't get into what all that implies about ERBs and standardized.
sure.
but I guess I just did. But I do think that we commit a great disservice if we get caught up in sort of this. I'm not sure what the benefit is of first in class or
right.
third in class. In what way or according to what criteria, all this kind of stuff, you know, estimating the student for who they are is a much better thing than estimating everyone by how they compare with everyone else in the class.
Right.
Especially if you teach an art like writing. Certainly there are things that make great writers and other things that will really hinder writing, but my goal is to take someone who's at a particular level and move them up the ladder of excellence in writing, not get them to change places in their progress in that class or something like that. I had the conversation one time with a lady who swore up and down that everybody in the class should be in the top 5% of the class. And I
that works for the first few.
Well,
but after,
mathematically, I just couldn't get there with her. I kept wondering about that other 95%.
Right, exactly.
Seems kind of lonely there.
Right. Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think, the metric, like the standardized test, the stuff you're talking about, it's
quantification.
The metric that you use, right? Like the what are you measuring? Or what are you hoping to quantify, as you say? I don't know. I mean,
that's the business model that has come into many homes and even home education settings and traditional schools is that we've got to quantify everything.
Right. Well, numbers are comfortable.
Yep.
And in numbers, it's easy to see improvement.
Yep.
Right. Because it's just, if it's bigger, that's improvement.
right.
Regardless
of what might be hidden behind that increase.
Right, exactly.
The fact that the score went up or that the average or median or whatever has improved is signs that we're doing the right thing.
Right,
or
right.
Inflating our grades.
Right. whoa. So have you seen, this is not a particularly good metaphor, but I think it will serve the purpose. Have you seen that movie with Kevin Costner and I think it's Ashton Kutcher? It's like a swimming movie?
Yeah.
About like the Coast Guard?
Coast Guard, right, yeah.
So
I forget what it's called. I think it's called Coast Guard.
But. No, it's like Far Away or Far Swim or something. I don't know.
He's teaching.
Kevin Costner is all-time greatest survival rescue swimmer.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Ashton Kutcher is
young buck.
Gonna be the next best.
Yep.
Right? And so the all throughout the movie, spoiler alert everybody, okay? Ashton Kutcher's character just keeps asking this guy, this old guy, what's your number? What's your number? That is, and the number is how many people you've saved, right? And everyone's estimating Kevin Costner's number to be 200. Some say it's 250. No, 300, mm-hmm. right? And at the end of the movie, Ashton Kutcher asks him one last time, what's your number? And he says, I think the number he says is 14. And Kutcher is kind of taken aback. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, that's good. That's good. It's not as many as people were right. saying, yeah, but right. but 14 lives, that's still, it's good that you saved that many. And Kevin Costner's character says, whoa, that I saved, what do you mean? And he says, well, that's your number, how many you saved. And he said, no, 14 is how many I lost. Mm-hmm. I don't keep track of how many I saved. They're saved.
Right.
You know, I'm sure it's written better than that, but the point remains, he was keeping track of the actual important thing.
Right.
He wasn't getting hung up on a number that makes you feel good, but is not the best way to estimate yourself. Right,
that number
yourself.
Goes up and you're worse.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. If his number had been 300, right. maybe we need to rethink the...
Right. Maybe he shouldn't be teaching the
the newbies.
The
yes.
school.
Right. Right. Well, for better or worse, I'm not sure if we've fully answered. I don't know that we can fully answer Josie's question, but it is almost a scary thing, when especially near the beginning of a school year when you walk in and you see a sea of faces that you don't know at all.
Hmm.
And your job is to try and move them forward, but to do so, you have to know where they are, to know where forward is. I agree wholeheartedly with my friend here. I would rather walk in assuming that they're capable of incredible things and have to be convinced that they're not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
then walk in yawning, okay, here's the bar, it's 3 inches off the floor. If we all step over, we can just have a party the rest of the year.
Right.
So I think it's important. I think it's a good question. I think especially... not everybody's going to have, quote-unquote, the same means to get to that end,
mm-hmm.
but it's a noble end of knowing your students well enough to have them not pigeonholed, not stuck
right
where they're at, but you know where they are and are encouraging them upwards and onwards, and
mm-hmm.
and they feel that. They know that you're in their corner.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of it. I think some of the worst thing you can do in estimating students is give them the wrong sense of why you're estimating them.
Mm-hmm.
That you're estimating them to improve them, not to keep them down.
Right.
Or heaven forbid that it's just to give them a grade.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
But to many, that is the only estimate. What's my grade?
Sure, sure.
What's my grade?
Sure.
And well, even that, I've had to do a lot of teaching about what I mean. Because I give letter grades, I shy away as much as I can from numeric grades.
Mm-hmm.
An A as an indication of excellence,
right?
Really hard.
It is.
Come by.
It is.
And if it isn't, I think there's a form of underestimation going on there.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically saying, well, everybody's an A student,
right?
And I've had that discussion. Some people believe that you start, quote unquote, with 100 and have to do wrong things to lose points.
Hmm.
Which is that numeric issue, right?
Right.
The perfect paper and what did I miss?
Right, right.
And for something like writing, language acquisition, I think this is true in math. Many things that you're building on.
Mm-hmm.
Ever increasing levels of facility with something.
Mm-hmm.
If you're starting them at 100, and you've some, you know, there's so much lying on you as the teacher to give the perfect test.
Exactly.
Whereas if I'm estimating that a C, for instance, is average work, you're hitting the standard.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I expected.
Sure.
You phoned it in, buddy.
Right.
And a B is, oh, you showed some effort here. Yeah. I can see ways in which you pushed yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And reserve that A for the wow.
Yeah.
Then it reveals more to the student and the teacher than if everybody's got an A unless you really screw up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not going to spend too much time today talking about D's and F's. I do give those out, but especially in writing, for instance, if I have enough time, I refuse to fail a student in a writing assignment.
Yeah, sure.
Because writing is in revision.
Revise. Right.
Now there's a question, can you follow directions?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
I've located for you places where you can improve and you refuse to improve it.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
I can give that grade.
Yep. Yeah.
But most of my students are thankful for the fact that there's a security in the fact that he's going to give me enough feedback that if I'm not content with the initial grade, I can keep working at it, because mm-hmm. that's my agreement with him. Until the grade has to be turned in finally,
right?
You can keep
work it out.
I was excited when my school moved to semester grades instead of quarterly grades, as it gave my students longer. They now have till Christmas,
yeah,
or May to Christmas and Memorial Day are like their only two real deadlines in writing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we've moved on to another paper.
Yeah.
They can come back, hey, I've been working some more on this and really trying to, you know. The sad thing is it's often the better students that try and make themselves even better.
Right. And they're like, it's fine.
So this is where the underestimation and overestimation, because if you've already given them a grade that doesn't leave much room for improvement, and they come back with a better paper.
It's like, right.
This is an A++. And this kind of nerdy stuff that we sometimes do.
That's funny.
I still haven't figured out what an A+ is, but we can talk about that sometime.
Yep. Yeah, we'll have to transition from here to assessment more directly. But in any event, we are grateful to Josie for throwing this one our way. And
make one more plea for our listeners to keep submitting good questions.
That's right.
It gets us excited and keeps the podcast fresh, I think.
Indeed. So we look forward to them, and we'll talk again.
Yeah. Keep your education.